Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan. The federal budget is coming up on May 9, and the University of Canberra's Institute for Governance and Policy Analysis is examining a range of aspects before and after its delivery. There will be modelling by NatSem, as well as articles and podcasts. Today, I'm talking with Jane Holton, who's former Secretary of the Finance Department. Late last year, she left the public service and is now in the corporate sector. Jane is also an adjunct professor at the University of Canberra. Jane, you had enormous experience of the budget process, including appearing at Cabinet's Expenditure Review Committee over nearly 30 years. Can you just describe how that process operates?
Sure, and it's probably important to remember that every government sets up its budget process to suit itself. But the thing that you can see consistently all the way through that period is the Expenditure Review Committee. And what that committee does, and sometimes it's called the Razor Gang, which usually comprises the Treasurer, the Finance Minister, and then a couple of senior ministers, looks at everything that the government is thinking of doing in terms of spending and savings for a budget process, or including for things like MyEFO, the Mid-Year Economic Financial Outlook. So they would scrutinise, and sometimes it's seen as interrogate, the ministers who bring forward proposals, things that they'd like to do, and they will either agree with them or ask for more information or say, no, we're not doing that, and they do exactly the same with savings proposals as well.
Putting together the budget's a really long process, isn't it? We have all this speculation in the last couple of months, but in fact they've been hard at it since, what, late last year?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's one of the things that people don't really understand. People would know, maybe sort of vaguely, that there's a statement that usually comes out just before the Christmas period, which is a kind of where are we up to statement, if you put it that way. But at the same time, governments are starting to think about what's going to be in their next budget. And I think a lot of people don't understand that the thinking goes all the way really from late October, maybe November, until that budget comes down in May. And it's a long and really carefully thought through process, which does get a little busy as you get into the last period, but certainly it's been going since well before Christmas.
Just on the Expenditure Review Committee, do the central departments, Treasury, Finance, Prime Minister and Cabinet, almost invariably have the whip hand, or can determined spending ministers get their way either for new programs or pushing off attempts to cut?
Well, of course, the inevitable balance is between fiscally conservative ministers at the centre who'd like to cut things and not spend anything, and spending ministers who by definition would like to spend money. So the challenge is always to strike that balance. And if you think about that process we just talked about, a government will decide, usually in the run into Christmas, what it thinks might be its priorities, and it will be asking ministers to do work on those things. And they will come forward with a series of proposals. And in the current world, we talk about things being fully offset, which is a nice way of saying if you want to spend something, you've got to save something. It's just like the household budget, you know. You want to save up for that nice holiday, well, you're going to sacrifice all those cappuccinos. So basically, a spending minister, if they want to actually bring forward something, are going to have to propose a savings measure. And the balance between the ministers does depend a little bit on personality, and it depends a little bit on what the circumstances are. So if you think about it, at the moment, things are a little tight. We know there's very limited wages growth. And they will, however, I expect, be slightly more revenue than they were expecting. So the balance between the spending and the savings ministers changes a little in that environment. If you go back and have a look at the old world, when there was lots of money around under Howard, it was easier being a spending minister in those days after Costello's first budget than it was certainly later in the piece. Later in the piece, there was money around to be spent. So smart ministers who have good political cases, if they understand the temper of the time, the context in which they operate, the balance shifts between the two.
Now, talking about changes and revenue, are things likely to be a little better because of changes in commodity prices or other factors? And the commodity prices seem to keep going up and down, don't they?
So basically, again, a bit like anyone's domestic budget, you have to kind of have an idea how much money's coming in order to decide what you can spend. And it's a pretty difficult thing to predict always how much revenue you'll have. We know that there is modest wages growth, but not a huge amount. We know that business will be paying a certain amount of tax, but we don't know quite how much. And obviously the amount of money you make from commodities is really important in terms of how much money is actually coming into government. So will there be less pressure in this budget? I mean, of course, I'm not on the inside anymore and I don't know, but you would have to predict based on commodities that there's probably slightly more coming in than there was previously. How long that'll be the case, well, Treasury has to estimate. But your expectation would be that they would still need to maintain discipline, even if there's slightly more coming in than there was. And we all know that the measures that had not been legislated, to take those off the books, actually cost the budget something. So this is probably their opportunity to do exactly that.
And you need to take these off the books at some point when they become incredible, because the rating agencies are going to say these figures really don't stack up anymore.
So there's quite a long tradition of governments saying they're still committed to policies. And you can go back and look at the last Labor government. You can go back and look under Howard. You can go and look prior to that, where people have remained committed to policies over a long period and the numbers have stayed in the budget. And in time, many of those measures have been legislated in one form or another. But it's a judgment that the government of the day makes as to whether they wish to say they're still committed to those policies. Now, as soon as they say they're not committed to those policies under budget honesty principles, you have to take them out of the numbers, and that can have a pretty significant effect on the bottom line.
Now, just those budget honesty principles, Peter Costello brought in the Charter of Budget Honesty. To what extent do you think that made a big difference? What was your experience of that?
Well, I do think it focused the mind. And having been through budgets from the perspective of someone going in and out of ERC and making submissions to ERC over a very long period, I can say that governments are very aware of it. And I do think it focused the mind about what you actually could genuinely do and what you can actually genuinely say and put your hand on your heart. It's not to say that people don't think creatively, because you'd expect them to, but I do think it's been quite a good discipline on people.
Also, what we've seen under the Turnbull government have been big changes in thinking during the budget process. For example, we had consideration of a big tax package involving changes of the GST a year ago, and we this time have had expectations of housing affordability being at the centre of the budget, and now those expectations being pulled back, so it's only one of a number of centres, as it were. What difference do those shifts in thinking make during a budget preparation process? What do they do to the public service, for example?
Well, we always have to understand that the public service is there to serve. It's not to say, however, that people won't have been kind of grumbling into their cup of coffee when the direction appeared to be going one way and then it shifted in a different direction. I mean, people are there to do the business of the government and to do the policy analysis and the work in order to give government the opportunity to consider the issues. And when you see shifts, and we have seen some shifts in the rhetoric and obviously in the emphasis, that will be a function of people actually having had that work done and then having had those discussions. And while we talked about the length of the process, in truth, the really hard bits, the things that will frame your budget, those are the hard bits that will often get dealt with towards the latter part. And often, until you actually look at the policy options, understand their costs, their benefits, and understand the trade-offs with other things you might want to do, you don't really understand that until you get right down to the wire.
Do you feel that in the last 2 or 3 years, the whole issue of budget repair has diminished, that government is less focused on that and certainly the public are less focused on that?
So budget repair is something which is an insider's conversation and something you talked about, the rating agencies. People who pay attention to the overall financial performance of the country really care about
fixing the deficit.
Fixing the deficit. And I think it's very hard sometimes to explain to the broader community why deficit reduction is so important. I think it is still the case inside government. People understand that. The challenge is how you deal with that in talking to the public. And if you've had a bit of a false start, which I think we can all acknowledge there was, on deficit repair, it means the job becomes even more difficult.
It does seem to me that this budget is different from a normal budget, which comes at the beginning of the cycle, because the government is on the back foot politically, so this budget has to be one that's politically acceptable. It can't be the normal hard budget of the cycle. What do you think?
Yeah. So, I mean, you're right. The orthodoxy inside government and certainly inside the bureaucracy, what you expect as a general rule is in that first budget after an election, you would go hard to deal with providing room for yourself to do the kind of policy things you'd like to do, and also to deal with perhaps some of the inefficiencies and things that you can stop doing. Obviously, in an environment where, one, the public is very sceptical, but secondly, your current electoral position's quite tenuous in terms of, you know, the numbers that you scored in the last election, it means this is quite a different budget. And what you would normally expect, I think, has to be balanced off, as you rightly point out, between that kind of political consideration. So you've got to manage the economics, you've got to manage your fiscal position, but you also have to be highly alert to what the public are going to think. And I mean, I think particularly framing things around fairness, we know that the public didn't like a world which was perceived by them not to be fair. And they have to be mindful of that.
So from the public service point of view, how would it be approaching this budget? Would some advisers, some departments be saying, you do need to be brave, we do need to fix up the underlying situation, where others are saying, well, we understand the politics?
I mean, it's always very tricky for the public service who are not politicians. And I've always had a great scepticism of people in the bureaucracy thinking they can understand the political world. You do in an intellectual way, but you're not living, eating, breathing it. So they will understand that this budget is not like the others for people who've been around a long time. They will also understand, certainly in the central agencies, how important the fiscal repair strategy is. Particularly people from the Treasury, Finance, PM&C perspective, they know that this, for the long-term future of the country, is incredibly important. And they will understand the challenge of balancing off all of those factors, because it's much more difficult to deliver things which are seen as fair, which, of course, everyone's got a good way to spend money, and no one ever wants to save any. And no one ever wants to make a contribution to the effort, particularly if they don't think that they're part of the collective. If everyone's making a contribution, you can kind of understand it, but if you don't feel that way, you're not happy.
From the public service point of view, does this come to be a contest between frank and fearless advice or realistic advice?
Well, frank and fearless advice should be the hallmark of any public servant who's worth their salt. But as I've said on many occasions, there's no point being frank and fearless in a world where you're not going to be heard. So frank and fearless has to be accessible. You have to understand who you're speaking to and what messages can be actually heard by the audience. So there's no excuse, to my mind, for not being frank and fearless. But you also have to be a realist and understand how it is you communicate the messages that need to be understood by people making the decisions.
Now, before I let you go, I must ask you about the National Party's push for departments to recommend areas that could be decentralised. Mm-hmm. They have said that, no, the Treasury won't be sent off to Whoop Whoop, but clearly they do want to get some areas out of Canberra. How do you think that'll be received, and is that a sensible approach?
So, I mean, obviously, as someone who's lived and worked in Canberra and being a proud Canberran, I listen to this with two perspectives, I suppose. But let's put the analyst's hat on. firstly, it's important to understand less than 40% of the APS, the Australian Public Service, works in Canberra. So the huge majority of public servants are not in Canberra. And
that's a really interesting figure. It doesn't come up much.
No, it doesn't. And I do think, and we all know that Canberra bashing is a bit of a sport, and we also understand that there's almost no merit from a politician's perspective in actually standing up for Canberra. But I do think it's important to understand that there are a significant number of people out and about. So what's the test that you should apply? To my mind is, does this make sense? And if you think about that, it's the nature of the work that you do. So there are many call centres in Tasmania, for example. We know that the ABS has created a very successful centre for data collection in Geelong. We know that the ATO has a very successful operation in Albury-Wodonga. So those are bits of the business that it makes a good deal of sense, continuity of staff, blah, 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 for people to be out and about. But you also have to say to yourself, if your job is to work with the government of the day, if it's to do policy, if it's to work with your colleague agencies, and I do believe in a cost-benefit test, and I do think that it's important that you analyse what can and should be properly done close to the centre of government, where people can talk to you, where they can come and make their case, where you can access the Senate committees and all the people you need to work with, as opposed to work which is perhaps of a processing or more technical nature, which might be best done and can be done elsewhere if that's your choice. But you also have to say, how efficient is it and how much does it cost?
Perhaps you should have a coffee with Barnaby Joyce.
Well, I mean, the Deputy Prime Minister is pursuing his agenda with a great deal of enthusiasm. We know that, and there's been a lot of commentary about it. We also know that some of the things that he's interested in having out and about probably can be done with reasonable sense and at a reasonable cost. I also think some of the things that you might lose in some of those functional areas are probably worth more in the longer run if they remain central.
Jane Holton, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.